Okay, last week, well, 2 weeks ago, we talked about why it wasn't a local flood. Remember some of the basic things we kind of talked about? Why couldn't it have been a local flood? Some of the things we talked about.
Oh.
Why, they aren't even mentioned here necessarily, but, well, because it talks about covering the mountains. Wouldn't have to save the animals because there'd be animals. If it was only a local flood, a certain area, animals could have just moved to another place.
So could Noah.
Yeah. Move your family over there because I'm going to flood this place. That'd been a whole lot simpler and build this massive ark. So it just, the teaching of the Bible, it doesn't fit. People, you say it, and almost most, or many, I should say, commentaries on Genesis will mention it. Well, it's possible it was only from his perspective. Well, God said it was going to be 120 years roughly until he did it. He could have moved to the South America in 120 years. I mean, if it was, just get out of that Mesopotamian valley, it would have been pretty simple, straightforward. So how big was the ark? That dimension probably gets it, right? These dimensions?
That's about right.
We did these kind of size, but then something along that, maybe, probably that, I think that opening, that foot and a half opening in the top, probably is under the eave on the outside edges, but that's what, but this, in terms of scale, this is a person. Okay? So that's more like what it is. The animals being dwarfed by the size of this thing. And it would fit, actually, the distance lengthwise would put it not just in a football stadium, but would actually have it go from the stands to the other stands of a football stadium. That's how big it is. And so grasping the scale and height-wise, I think we talked about, if you go out, maybe after this class, go out to the parking lot, try and look at the building and look at the height from the ground to the peak, okay? And picture three of those, or close to that, in height. Okay? If you were to go look at a building, maybe that's three stories tall, you'd probably have to get more, in our dimensions we use, you'd have to probably see a building at least four stories tall to see how high the ark was. Because each floor could have been roughly 15 feet, from level to level, because it makes three levels in the ark. So I think what does in lots and lots of people about the story being impossible is not grasping how big he was told to build something. You wouldn't need to build something this big if it was just 8 people and a few animals, for a year. So the immenseness of it is difficult. And actually how big it was, probably on the smallest side, it's probably 95,000 square feet. So we compare that, it's the biggest home. Who here has kind of gone through like some mansions, like Hearst Castle and stuff like that? They tell you how many square feet it is?
35 to 40,000 square feet is a big, it's a huge mansion.
Exactly. Yeah. This thing is so much more square feet than even the largest mansions that exist. It's at least double, and it's probably more like triple. And so I think people just don't grasp the dimensions, because the images that everybody sees from childhood are those ones I first showed. This little teeny boat with giraffe's neck sticking out. And it's just, so you get an image that's just completely inaccurate. And so many people so the cubic foot of this thing is in the 1.5 million to 2.3 million. And remember we talked about cubits. I'm using two different standard cubits that existed in the ancient world. The Hebrews had a cubit. They had, at one, some point, they standardized to 17 and a half inches, roughly, by our dimension, or by inches. And an Egyptian cubit was 20, you know, basically 20 and 5/8 of an inch. Okay. What was Noah using? More than likely, he was using the length of it from the fingertips to his elbow, which I don't know how long that was in him. But to give you an idea, he wasn't a Hebrew. He is, he's kind of the other genetic material of almost everybody that's still alive, or at least he and his family does. And so the Hebrews were generally small people. The average height of a Hebrew male was only about 5'6". When we read about the Old Testament, it's only a few inches smaller than the average size of a male in, today in America. The average size of a male is 5'9". But we look at certain peoples, their average height is much taller than that, aren't they? Now, some, they're smaller. Others are taller. We look at certain nations. But even just in Africa alone, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, one of the reasons, if you look at basketball players, vastly majority African American, they're far more than that than just African American descendants. They are Western African American descendants. Okay, because Western Africa has very large African native population. They're very big, powerful. Eastern is not that way. Look at the runners, distance runners. You know, a lot of them are usually African. The winners of marathons are often coming from sub-Saharan Africa, but the eastern side, and you see how small they are. They're not tall, and they're not big. They are very thin, and actually quite short. And so, it isn't just within Africa itself. There are different peoples with really different sizes that we don't. You know, sometimes people grasp. Well, the Hebrews are not especially tall, so their cubit will probably have been smaller. But somewhere in these numbers is how big the ark is. How big was a clipper ship? It would hold 25 to 50 people who could stay out at sea 4 to 5 months. And it would take, I think this is one of the things you're talking with people. If you just kind of want a quick little jerk, it's like, how could God put all the animals on an ark? Say, well, you know, the ark would have held about maybe 20, 25 clipper ships of stuff. The amount of square feet of a clipper ship, if you just took the dimensions of 212 by 21 and you did that as a rectangle, you'd come up with 8,900, two levels. In reality, it's not a rectangle, that's the widest point. And actually curves like this. So it probably is only about 6,000 or so square feet. And you're talking, you know, 20 of those at least probably, or somewhere in that neighborhood. You say, well, how much could you put on that? Well, see, now you're getting, to help people get an impression of how much the ark could have held. You go, oh. And everybody have kind of, clipper ship is kind of that main picture we see of the old wooden boats, you know, sailing, you know, with the big masts and things. So I think that's a good barometer to kind of for scale, how big. So who was on the ark? This is kind of where that's where we left off. So who's on the ark? Land mammals, right? They don't have to put fish on the ark. So all the sea creatures, all the water creatures don't have to be put on. So we're eliminating all of that life. They're going to be able to survive in the water. So everything that's on land, though, we're going to have to bring in. Okay. Reptiles, right? So mammals, reptiles, birds. And we see those on mentions on there. Dinosaurs. You know, think about dinosaurs. We picture dinosaurs really large, right? But almost every, even the kind of fantasy stories about dinosaurs, how are they born?
Eggs.
How big are those eggs? Even the largest ones, really, this big. They're smaller than your dog, your small dogs. How are you going to, if you're going to bring animals on the ark, are you going to bring full-grown adults that have already lived for a long period of time in a certain environment? That wouldn't even be smart from a human perspective. If I need to survive this confinement for a while and then come out of it in a different scenario even, I'm going to want to bring in animals that are young, maybe even in their eggs. Let them hatch on the... But I'm going to bring them young prior to even mating and let them, be small while in the ark. I'm going to bring the biggest. And one of the oldest, because one of the things, a couple of things, not young, I guess it's true of people as well as almost every animal, they, when they're really young, adapt to different circumstances than when they have grown used to certain things. It's more difficult for them to kind of change into a different environment. So for all kinds of reasons, you would have put, animals that were much smaller. And the thing about dinosaurs, I don't know if everybody's is aware of this. Most dinosaurs, we think, are reptiles. Most of the ones you see in Jurassic Park movies and stuff, they kind of look that they're reptiles. And do you know how reptiles grow?
Very close. In the size that they're contained.
Yeah. They can grow as big as, if they have enough space and food, they can keep growing for their entire life.
Like if you keep them in an aquarium.
Right.
They're just
going to
get that big.
It won't get bigger than its environment. And so, if the ancient world before the flood, in fact, was this whole globe, and there's lots of evidence, this entire globe, at one point was essentially a rainforest, a forest that just misted, moist, and plants grew like crazy, and there's no limit. What they could eat. And there was no limit in terms of space. Unlimited space. Unlimited food. But after the flood, why do we not see those same dinosaurs that we dig up? The environment after the flood changes a lot. We don't have a rainforest. We have now mountains capped with snow, which it wasn't when Noah lands. When the ark lands on Mount Ararat, wasn't covered in snow then. And now we have kind of bands where it's difficult to live. And we see, we unearth lots of even elephants and things that have been in the farthest northern places in the earth. But there's no way they could survive now. So the environment has to have changed dramatically. I would suspect most of what we call dinosaurs, they died out. But see, we call things like the saber-toothed tiger, right? That's kind of a dinosaur. That's like a dinosaur age. Isn't it still a tiger with long teeth? It's still a tiger. It's just a subspecies of a tiger. Did certain kinds of tigers go away and only certain other tigers survive? Probably. But, and see, we have this kind of, the science gives us this misnomer, that there's all these animals that lived this way and then it kind of all went away and then, new life kind of sprung up in its place. Where lots of those dinosaur type things still exist. Is there a crocodile? Isn't it like a dinosaur? Yes, a lot like a lot of them. In fact, they liken a lot of the, like some crocodiles and alligators that have that rough kind of armored skin. They compare that to, they think, some of the old dinosaurs had. I think they would have brought in, and actually the majority of dinosaurs they talk about, most of them are small. We always have these really large ones, the Brachiosaurus, Brontosaurus, and most of them are small, like size of a chicken. There's a handful of them that are large, but most of them are small that we have found. Amphibians. So you go, well, okay, they can be on water or land. Most amphibians could not be only in the water for a year or for half a year. So you probably would have like frogs, right?
Turtle.
Some of those, yeah. It would be difficult. Now, I don't know if it's impossible, but you probably would bring a lot of the amphibians aboard as well.
They'd probably take the eggs.
Yeah. If it were me making the decision, I would.
Well, not necessarily the frogs.
Now, the only thing that probably goes against the egg thing is he said male and female. One problem is just taking an egg, unless God's told you, okay, this one's female and this one's male. You might need to know they're both. You might need another sex before to bring them on. Okay, so so some animals now extinct. Probably most of the animals that are extinct. In fact, most of the extinct animals that we are aware of in biology have not become extinct because of man in recent centuries. Most of them are extinct because, wow, there were these kind of creatures roaming the earth before. And we don't see them anymore. And some of the ones that people thought were extinct years ago have actually been found. Because they're in places like the Brazilian rainforest, where people don't travel in very big numbers. And then we've got the eight people. So who's on the ark? We have to have enough space for all of these, right? So we talk about the animals. So we talk about the dog. Species, the family dog, familiaris. That's separate from, say, the wolf or fox. So that's the species level. We call the species. So a wolf is a different species than the family dogs. And we know all our family dogs, though, are essentially all related to the same, a common ancestor dog, right? In fact, even evolutionists tell us that all dogs and all things like a dog come from a common ancestor, right? That's what evolution teaches. And so when we think about what we need to bring on board, do we need to bring a canine familiaris, and a canine that's a wolf, and a canine that's a fox? Do we need all of those? Or is there a common ancestor to all of them? So, the wolf and the dog are clearly related. They can intermix. They can mate with one another as long as the wolf doesn't kill the other dog. I mean, they are different types of dogs just because of their environments and how they're raised and grow. But they are still related, and we know that genetically. And so we're going to use genus as the number, how we would put what animals we need to bring to the ark. So in order to figure out how many animals would have to be on the ark, this particular, his book, is going to assume we're going to need to take two of every genus, okay? So we have to have at least a couple of animals that are going to give rise to wolves and dogs and, okay? But the other thing is many animals, the family that the canines are in is Canidae. And that actually is not only the family dog and the wolf, but it's also the fox and others. So, and in fact, in biology, at the family level, a great deal of animals actually can mate and reproduce. Okay. Now, you can think about even something like a horse and a donkey. They're both similar kinds of animals, but they actually can't mate and reproduce. They can create a mule, but that mule is feral. So they can do one, and then that's it. A mule can't reproduce itself. So the only way you get mules is keep taking donkeys and horses and putting them together. And so at the family level, a lot. Now, and this is much smaller. If at this level they only needed to bring a pair of animals at this level, we're probably only talking between, say, 2,000 and 4,000. Now, we're going to use genus because that's probably, we know we can get all the species from the genus that we have today. So how many are there? So you have, then the above family, you have the order. So carnivores, so that's, at this level, the cat, the bear, the mouse, the dog, they're all related to wolf. They're all carnivores. Okay? And then you have the class of mammalia, the all the mammals. So that's us, a hippo, a cow, a dog, well, you know, all mammals. And so looking at it, what happens is, and you probably, if you've had discussions with people, like, oh yeah, like, ARC's impossible. What most people picture is, how could I get every species on the ARC? So that means I have to have a pair of Dalmatians, I gotta have a pair of Dachshunds, I got. No. So I just have to have a pair of animals that give rise to all the dogs. And possibly wolves, and possibly foxes, and all of them. And so, like we even see, because when we think about like a dachshund is a family dog, but it's also a subspecies, isn't it? It is a, it's been mated to, we've taken certain ones and we've created a certain type. And we want, and we just kind of keep mating them with each other, which is why all the purebred dogs, most of them have problems, genetic problems now, because they've been intermated so long. And that's why they're crossing them so much now. But we understand that, that all the dogs have a common ancestor. Almost every kind of dog, if you go research it, goes, well, this one came from this, and that came from that. And they kind of go back, and how kind of came, how did they get a dachshund? These little tiny short legs. Well, they kept taking dogs of a certain, you know, class, and they kept taking the ones with smaller and smaller legs. You know? And they also bred a certain mentality into them. They say, we have dachshunds, you know, we understand. Dachshunds have kind of short man's complex. They think they're the toughest dog around. And they act like it, even though they're tiny. But that's their fierceness to go after a lot of creatures in the ground. They have to be fierce to chase anything. And that was bred into them that way. We understand, we know that. But most people think, you can't get this many. So how many species are there? So let's kind of look. So all these different things. So the number of species is estimated between 2 and 50 million. This is where it's essentially impossible, isn't it? On this amount of space that we've identified with the ARC, we're not getting 2 million animals on it. I mean, unless they're a quarter of an inch big. And so this is what everybody pictures. I've got to have, you know, two dogs and a couple wolves and a couple fox. And we don't need that. For all of those species to exist today, they have common ancestors. We just need a common ancestor of all these canines. And when you look at the number of genera, that's the plural for a genus, 15,754, now that's the number. This is actually, it's almost two decades old now, this number, and I haven't re-examined it. Wouldn't surprise me, the number's a little bigger, but roughly 16,000. So 7,500 almost mammals, 4,600 birds, 3,700 reptiles. And that's the number that in that the book is going to assume. We need to get a pair of genus animals that can give rise to all the different species of animals. Okay? Does that make sense, everybody? So that's the assumptions kind of built into the estimate. Okay, so number of families. So in order, well, it could be as little as 2,000. So it could be only a couple thousand. Now I would suspect that our classification system is probably not, doesn't relate perfectly to God's kinds. I think his kind is somewhere in the genus or family level. But I think in some things that we classify genus might be his kind, and some that we classify family might be more what God talks about his kind. And so because it is true that many different families can actually interbreed. At the family level, they can still interbreed and reproduce offspring. And so God's kinds, the way he described it, was animals that could reproduce after their kind. And in a very short period of time, so just even look at humans, He creates Adam. And from Adam's DNA, every human on the face of the earth has his DNA in some form. Right? Because even Eve is just a clone of Adam. Just taking his X chromosome, or the X line strand, and put another X strand next to it instead of a Y. So every male has the genetic code to make a female. And so he took it from Adam, made her. But she's still just his clone, to some degree, to at least that part of it. When we think about animals, well, that's to say, if you think about all the human beings on the face of the earth, talked about West Africans versus East Africans, very different size, shape. Pygmies of Australia, you think about, Vikings of, Scandinavia. We pictured Vikings were bigger, weren't they, typically? You start looking through the different places on earth and you go, look at all these different people from Asia to Africa have a common father. And actually genetics tells us that's true, doesn't it? We know that's true. We have a common ancestor. All human beings have a common ancestor. And so it fits. The only question really is science, evolutionist wants to say how it takes an incredible long period of time to get that. But almost everybody did almost everybody had a biology class, right? Talk about genetics a little bit. They almost all talk about the one genetics test of taking two medium brown people who have the genes, kind of dark and light, of lots of melanin and hardly any melanin. And if they reproduce in their children, if they had, say 16 children, you're going to have some that are going to be very dark and some that are going to be very light. It doesn't take even two generations. One generation, you can get different colors. And so you get different heights, you get different sizes, and then those different mixtures start mixing with each other, and so you end up with Scandinavians who are all very light skinned. Right? My ancestors on one side. Yeah, and at the other end, then, as they got, the Tower of Babel probably explains why mankind is not kind of just a mix like India is. And we talked about that a couple weeks ago. India, it has that mix. India does have very light-skinned Indians and very dark-skinned Indians who are as dark as Africans are. And so we see that, but their culture's always been that way. So they have that medium, they have their genetics of the Indian people has both light and dark, and so you have this natural mix. Why in some places do we not have it? More than likely because at Tower of Babel, when they split according to families, some of the families had certain traits, and so that people took on those traits, and others took on other traits. So they split. The Babel probably explains how we end up with this, places in the world that have a certain type of person and not others. So I think, personally, the number probably could be 4,000 or 5,000. And if it was only 4,000 or 5,000 animals they had to bring on, that would have been easy. 16,000 is more tricky, we might say, but still doable, which is what we're going to essentially look at. We're going to be looking at how big were the animals. Kind of give you a little preview here. Look very early. Any thoughts about though the animals that have to bring on, or which ones would be more difficult?
Roger, there's a common occurrence in Texas. You don't see it up here as much, but people have let domesticated pigs have gotten loose. And matter of fact, it's a huge problem. They're feral hogs.
Oh, yeah.
And what's interesting is they resort back. They do not look like a pig in a farm. And within one or two generations, they resort back having the tusks, hair all over their body. They stink. They weigh 400 pounds. And in Texas, you're allowed to hunt them all year long, as long as you're not shooting in the city. And it's almost impossible to wipe them out. They mate so fast. But you have pink, little pink cute pigs that turn into their ancestral look. And I don't know, maybe they all found one big ugly pig and made it with him, but it's amazing that you do see animals resorting back to this, moving up to the out of species, mm-hmm. back to family. You see this occur in nature. Sure. And I mean, that's the best example I've ever seen, is in a short period of time, they go from being a cute pig you think you'd eat to an ugly animal you wouldn't eat it at all.
And you can think about it, you know, even if you took it from dogs and said, you know, okay, we're going to mix these dogs and those dogs, and if we're going to start mixing all the dogs back together, could we actually get back to something that was much more like the original? Probably. Because, it's much, like even, tigers and lions can be mated. Now, they don't naturally mate in the wild. They would kill each other naturally in the wild, but they can, in a zoo, they can actually be mated to create a liger. And they mated them. But somehow some kind of feline, gives rise to both of those. So there's some kind of ancestors that's a little different. Now, but if you take, you take a few regular pigs, you put them out into the feral pig hog community, and they start mating with them, pretty soon their children, they're going to kind of dominate. And one of the things that happens is at that higher level, what's their DNA like? It's not the recessive genes. The dominant has got the dominant genes in it. And so you take the recessive genes, and you're going to, if you keep mating it with the dominant genes, you're going to get rid of that recessive pretty quickly. It won't continue as much. That's a great point about another point about that too. This kind of goes off from animals, but a lot of people think evolution is this kind of one-way arrow, right? So one of the great examples of evolution that was stated in the 1800s was the trees in Europe. I don't know if everybody remembers that. The trees in Europe, and it was a certain moth. Maybe that moth you knew.
The peppered moth.
It was light with little dark flecks in it. Okay, and then in Europe at the mechanical revolution, basically all this machinery pumping out soot like crazy, and their trees turned dark, and the peppered moths changed, and they became dark. And the reason is, peppered moths normally sat on certain trees with a kind of, almost like, those kind that kind of flake off in our area. What's those called? Yeah, they have a white, kind of white
birch.
Birch does that, and there's some others. But so they would get on these trees that they blended in with. Well, now the trees are turning darker because of the soot, and now the birds are eating all the light moths. And so the light moths went away, and all the peppered moth was dark now. And they use that in biology classrooms all the time. Did anybody ever tell you that the peppered moth is now white again?
Yes.
In class, in biology? Well, that's good. You don't need to hear it too much.
I've never heard of
the
peppered moth.
Yeah. Peppered moths, because once they cleaned up the air and got rid of the soot, the trees went back to lighter, and all of a sudden the darker moths were being eaten more, and the lighter moths came back. Huh.
But there were always light and dark moths.
That's right.
The point.
There always were.
Adaptation that God put in the kind.
So when the circumstances change, certain ones survive better than others. And when the circumstances change back, they went right back to what they were before. It wasn't this kind of one-way arrow that all of a sudden they became better. It just adapted to its environment. So like even in science, the idea of survival of the fittest is a true principle. The question, the idea that whatever is going to survive that atmosphere or that, environment will survive better than something that can't survive in that environment. So, I'm just gonna give you a little bit of a kind of a looking forward. How big were the animals? 1 kilogram is about 2.2 pounds, okay? And so, When you look at mammals, you know, you got to put some in categories. So to 10 grams, 100 grams, 1 kilogram, so 2 pounds. So if you look at the numbers here, you have, what is that, 28, 29, yeah, over 3,000 mammals that are less than 2 pounds. And these are all adult sizes, by the way, not their chub. And so, as you start to get very large, you know, 1 ton, 10 tons, you know, elephants and things like that, hippos, there's not that many different species of those. Right? Birds, same thing. Most birds are less than 2 pounds, or 2 pounds or less. You know, only very few that are above that. Reptiles, similar. Similar, we see, you know, we see reptiles. Notice how reptiles go out there. There's much bigger numbers up here than down there. Or there's much bigger numbers there at the top than there are of mammals and birds. Because mammals and birds kind of have a set size by their DNA. Reptiles don't. And so reptiles, it's just kind of like whatever the environment allowed. It's how big they can get. And how long they should live. Because that's the other thing. They're only going to grow so much a year kind of thing. And so if they can live a long, long time, like before the flood, if people were living 1,500 years, how long were animals living? Well, a lot of animals still live much longer than people. The parrots live like 100 years.
Macaws.
Yeah, tortoises. Yeah, there are some animals that outlive people, still. And if you think before the flood, and if people were living to be, you know, 1,000 years old, and if animals were doing the same thing, how big would those animals have gotten in 1,000 years? Especially reptiles. Well, I think we dig them up. I think we know how big they would have gotten because we dig them up out of the earth. But if you give them a much shorter lifespan, are they going to get that big? No. And if an animal that needs a lot of food every day can only survive in certain places. And so that's why you only see, you know, hippos in certain places. You know, elephants in certain places. You know, they have to have certain kind of environment and quantity of food. And there are going to be so many of them within that environment, too. Because if there's too many of the animal and not enough food for all of them, they're going to begin to die out of that as well. So, actually, a lot of times, we just have this image that animals probably, the numbers of animals are a lot bigger. The vast majority of animals would have been very small. And if you took their babies or the young ones, you're talking ounces. You could have really easily gotten half the number of animals that are needed on here, at least, probably more than half, that are in the less than a pound, just ounces. So 8,000 or so. Anyway, so we'll look at that a little bit more and talk about how tiny all the animals were. Any other kind of thoughts or questions or just comments on what we were talking about? In reference to the species, how many there would be. So I'm going to roughly use the number 16,000, and that's what this is going to use as an assumption. 16,000 animals is what's going to be needed to be put on there. Do we have room for 16,000 pairs, I should say?
Little ones.
So he has already done the math to kind of look at the mass, how much mass the ark would hold, how much mass is being told to put on it. There's going to be a lot of, he does a lot of figuring of those things out. Is it even possible to have fed 16,000 animals or prepared food over, you know, for a year? It's a lot of food, right?
More is going on.
Yeah, and actually he takes into account that very thing, because when you look at mass, the animals would be growing, right? And some of them even reproducing. Well, it would also be eating up the food. So the food mass is going away while the animal mass is growing. And so he actually does a little bit of a mathematical equation in that process as well. So, I don't know, I'm probably not going into it in great detail, but a little bit. So, anything else? Otherwise, we're done a few minutes early. Yeah.
Tara's studying genetics and biology right now, and we were just talking about this from the standpoint of our family, because I'm part German and part English, And Brian's part German and part Irish. But we got to thinking about it. That means our kids are more German than we are.
That's weird, but they are.
And you think of these things continuing to mix and getting to be a bigger dilution. But in this case, actually, our kids are more German than we are.
There was that exact same line. There was a study done, it's been maybe the last 10 years or so, of the Palestinians and the Israelis. And DNA-wise, they're almost identical. They're not really genetically different. They have been intermarrying for a long time. And they've only been, Jewishness has been kept by the line of mothers, because, it's gone through mothers now since, I think maybe that second, third century or something. Because it used to be, in the Old Testament, to be Jewish, you had to be through your fathers, right? Well, the problem was when their people were dying in war, who dies at a greater rate? Males. The people that survive war, especially in wars where they try to wipe you out, are the females. And so they actually begin to turn, and I don't know what it was exactly, but the Jewish people began to say, well, okay, we're going to count you as Jewish if your mother is Jewish. And they began to trail it that way. So Jewishness today, Jews really aren't any different. It was kind of a surprise to me that the Jews and the Palestinians are not really different genetic peoples. They just came from different heritages, people teaching different things. They have common ancestry within their DNA. I don't know, anybody seen the test online or the commercial online where you can 23andMe or something like that? I think you can send in like a cheek swab, they'll do a DNA and they'll tell you, they can kind of tell you what you are. Because you look at the DNA and go, oh, that those traits are Irish.
I did it through ancestry.com.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
Yeah. It's like $99. It was interesting to me,
Did it come out what you thought?
Yes and no, because like my closest ancestors that came, because I have ancestors in the United States from the 1600s, but the closest ones were from Bavarian Germany, and I actually didn't have any German in me, which I thought was interesting. But there was everything around it, so depending on where they then immigrated into Bavarian Germany from, But yeah, I'm as white as white can be.
Yeah, I think thought this, you see the politics here is a little bit of a, thing made about President Clinton he was giving a speech, and he talked about how we're all kind of black anyway. Then he was talking about DNA, and he said, because he likes the label of being the first black president. And he goes, DNA has proven recently that we're all pretty much mixed race anyway, unless you're from sub-Saharan Africa and absolutely like pitch black. We're all kind of mixed.
Were you meaning Obama or did Clinton?
No, that's Clinton who said it.
Clinton
who said it. Yeah.
He's trying to steal being the first black president.
He still wants to be the first black president.
Wait a minute.
Yeah. It's kind of why it didn't go over very well. He was actually talking to a black audience and things, so.
Okay. Didn't go very well. Ancestors are probably rolling over there, right?
Yeah.
Whirling.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's all I have for today. Any other thoughts or? Okay. So we're going to be going forward, assuming 16,000. I think you've kind of given that as well, right? 16,000 on the earth.
On the number, yeah, I've seen it as high as 70,000, but you can get to reality, anywhere between those numbers. The as a ship, it would certainly carry that number of people, but the way boats work, you just displace water. Water actually weighs a lot, so if the boat just gets heavier. You add something that's like 20% heavier, the boat only goes down like an eighth of an inch or something like that. So
I don't know. I've thought So I suspect whatever tree he was told to use probably had some quality that actually helped in the process of it floating. But
it had a buoyancy to it, yeah.
Because we know certain woods float and other woods sink.
Well, even
it's probably why he specified what kind of wood I want you to use.
Even driftwood, if you keep it in the water long enough, it's going to sink.
And you know, if it was something like cedar actually also, you know, is resistant to water real easily.
Yeah.
Could have sat in water for a long period of time and not rotted. Because we have no idea what the gopher wood actually is. It's because it's just a sounding of the Hebrew word. That's what it came from. Okay. Well, that's it. Appreciate everybody's time today.
Do you know why the Mormon Church does all that? Ancestry.com?
So they can be baptized for the dead.
No, but they actually believe that it is their God gave them the duty to re-record back who begat who all the way back to the Bible. I the only reason I know that is a bunch of the Mormon eldership, the leaders, came to Dell and they were trying to figure out how to store the records so that in case of loss of civilization, it wouldn't be all on a hard drive somewhere. So their concept was they were trying to figure out how we could not lose that information again. And they think it's their God-given duty to do that, which is why they created Ancestry.
Keep the lineage.
Interesting. Yeah, so they're trying to recreate, you know, the Book of Numbers. Yeah, that's why they do that stuff for so cheap.
Well, and they also do. They do baptize for the dead. They take young children and.
Oh, they do that too. If you have an old piece of paper in your family that like is a birth certificate that's 400 years old, and you go to try to open it, it'll start falling apart. Yeah. They actually have people that could open that, scan it, and they'll mount it and send it back to you.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, they do all kinds of stuff like that, but it's all based on their twisted Christian belief that they are recreating the Jewish temple.
We need the lineage.
Yeah, the lineage.
I find
so all you did was give the Mormons
more information.
Yeah, more information on you.
That's okay.
Not like they can do anything with it.
It's still probably a cost.
But by the way, when they were there, they were actually trying to get us to figure out is writing it holographically. Because there's so much information, how do you restore it? And I couldn't help myself. I said, write it on gold tablets. Because, I mean, what can you read 10,000 years from now if man has lost the ability to make a computer again? Yeah. You know, you can't read hard drives. Well, have you seen that new chip that is like it's a microchip? Yeah, yeah. It's clear and like these glass. That's actually they're going down is trying to make it microscopic because they think with a very simple set of instructions they can teach you how to make a microscope. So they were looking at like press latinum and things like that where you can write real time. You know, I couldn't care less.
And wasn't there one just made like 300 and some terabytes?
Yeah, it's the size of a quarter. It's clear. If you ever go in the Guinness Book of World Records Museum, somebody has written like the entire Bible on like an 8x10 sheet of paper by hand. And if you look at it at a microscope, the whole book of Genesis is about that big. Somebody by
the microscope, can you actually read it?
Only if you hold a glass to it.
But I mean, if you have a microscope, you get it. Somebody who actually wrote it that small.
But
they actually made letters.
So some humans actually wrote it. I mean, it's just amazing that a human could write that small.
They looked at all.
Are they blind now?
I don't know. Other than just being amazed by that, but I'm thinking, well, that's how you write. And now remember, you have to write the generations of the equivalent of about 8 billion people. Yeah, good luck.
I know the. Have you ever seen the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit?
No, I haven't seen the exhibit. I've seen photos.
What hit me was how small they wrote on.
Yeah.
And that they didn't know there were no borders.
Paper was costly.
And so you on both sides.
Yeah.
You filled the thing up. And that reminded me, so you, as you go back, you're like, four glasses.
But the name was actually
how quickly you would need other people to read.
In Jerusalem, if you go down to their wailing wall and all that, you somehow work your way around some set of steps, and you go by, and there's a guy in their handwriting of the Bible in Hebrew. They still, I think they do it 24 hours a day, and I don't think they're doing it to write Bibles, obviously. They're doing it to kind of maintain the scribe, the heritage of the scribe. Yeah, but there's a little booth filled with glass windows.
Are those the, or is that still the Nazarene?
Yeah, it could be. There are so many sects of the Jews that to see them sitting there bowing, and they have little children.